Welcome to Storm of Spoilers Off Season Tour. My name is Joanna Robinson, and if I could do one thing the way Ethan Hunt does it, it would be running. Have you seen that dude run? His knees go up to his ears.
And I'm Neil Miller, and if I could do anything the way that Ethan Hunt does it, it would be riding a motorcycle very fast through traffic going the wrong way.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez, and if I could do anything the way Ethan Hunt does it, it would be gaslighting my wife, who seems to be perfectly okay with years of this shit.
Also, as I learned from watching Mission Impossible 3, which was the last one that I watched before we recorded, very good at getting away with lying to her his entire life.
Mm-hmm.
So,
that movie
cool.
does in 3 where he's like, he throws the ice outside, then he goes, "Hey, babe, we're out of ice." I'm like, that's a sociopath.
Also, does he have a roommate in that movie? Did I miss that?
I don't think so. Why?
I swear he has a phone call where he, like, calls a roommate.
He's talking to her brother, played by Aaron Paul. Is that what you're thinking of?
Yep. That explains it.
Okay. That's her brother.
Got it.
This week, in case you haven't caught on, we're talking about the Mission Impossible movies. There are 5 of them, and then Mission Impossible Fallout. So, we're going to discuss all of them. That's how we're going to divide it. First section, first 5 Mission Impossible movies. Second section, Fallout with some, indeterminate spoiling. We're going to figure it out. Comes out this week. But before all that, some announcements. This week's bonus segment, if you are a Patreon member, patreon.com/StarWarsSpoilers, at the Maester or above level, you will be getting a bonus segment about Comic-Con reactions. Comic-Con was last week in San Diego, and trailers and things came out. Usually we do like a whole episode about that, but it was a slightly lesser Comic-Con for our key demographics. That's going to be in the bonus segment. Make sure and check it out. And Joanna, do we have any reviews?
Well, yes, we do. We have... We have one from If You See Corey, 5 stars. The title is A More Than Fun, Fine Time at the Podcast. You know how you say something and you don't realize it's going to become a catchphrase and then it does? Yeah, that's what happened there. Okay, so this person wrote, I came across Storm of Spoilers a few years ago when I became steeped in the Joannaverse. I appreciate what each host of the show brings to the discussion of both Game of Thrones and off-season tour topics. I don't think Neil is a loser, even if Joanna and Dave called him one on the podcast a couple weeks ago.
I did have a really prolific losing streak.
We were talking about the Great Debates.
So, speaking of which, fair.
Did we ever announce who won the Great Debates? No. Cool.
Hold on, I'll look that up.
Yeah, we're going to announce who won the Great Debates, but... If this magically gets read on air, Joanna, please insert as many pew pew pews into it as possible. Uh oh, it's too late. Pew pew pew. My new favorite storm chasing sound effect that should replace the thunder. Me thinks. So pew pew pew. Thanks for that review. If you see Corey.
That would be so confusing if we took away the sound effects and just added pews. Be like, we're going storm chasing. Pew, pew, pew. Pew. The segment for inside jokes.
So that's a review.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Neil, do you have the winners of the Great Debates
of
best television show and best movie of 2018 so far?
Yes. Based on several rounds of polls, we've determined that Atlanta, with 30% of the final round vote, is the best TV show. But that one was super close between Atlanta, Killing Eve, and The Americans, essentially. The movie one was not close. It was Black Panther in a runaway, 56% of the vote for Black Panther. Paddington 2 came in at number 2. So, Atlanta and Black Panther.
What we're learning here is we're getting worse at curating these great debates, but that the good news is we have a lot of TV to catch up on that apparently is amazing.
Yeah,
that's how I read those results. Good job, guys. We figured that out. No need to debate it any further until the second half of 2018. for sure. Neil, it's time for you to bring the thunder.
Yes, it is time to go storm chasing.
Pew, 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 pew.
I love that our podcast just turns into Hurricane Heist every week. Yeah. So we're going to talk about one movie, show, book, story, podcast, etc. that we are interested in. This week I'm not going to go first. Because when I saw what Joanna picked for hers, I'm so in support of it that I would like her to go first. So, Joanna, what is your storm this week?
Well, speaking of Black Panther running away with the movie poll earlier, we are in the midst of what I have decided deeply uncreatively to call the Oaklandissance. If you don't know, I live in Oakland, California, which is the Bay Area, home of the Warriors, right across the bridge, the Bay Bridge from San Francisco. And there have been several films this year set in Oakland. Black Panther isn't set in Oakland, obviously set in the real place of Wakanda, but it's bookended in Oakland, if you may recall. And there are two movies out right now set in Oakland, and there's a fourth called Jin, which I have not seen yet, but I'm interested to see. But two out right now are Sorry to Bother You and Blind Spotting. They are incredible films, not just because they're set here. Sorry to Bother You is by Boots Riley. It stars Lakeith Stanfield and Tessa Thompson, Steven Yeun, Armie Hammer, and Danny Glover, and a number of other people. And it is an incredible, like, weird, satirical look at sort of capitalism and race relations and the working class and everything. It's just got so much going on. And the thing, I've seen it twice now. It's really funny. And then it's also just like really sort of like really poignant and piercing at the same time. And it takes a really weird turn in its last act, which some people can hang with, some people can't. When I saw it for the second time this last weekend, I leaned over to my friends and I was like, it's about to take a turn. Just stay with it. And some of them did, some of them didn't. And that's fine. But it's just a really, really fantastic movie. Then the other one that I want to highlight is Blind Spotting, which is by director Carlos Lopez Estrada, and it stars Rafael Casal and David Diggs. This is also David Diggs of Tony Award-winning Hamilton fame. He played Jefferson and Lafayette, and he is not doing a French accent in Blind Spotting. David and Rafael both, I believe, are Oakland natives. Boots Riley is an Oakland native. Ryan Coogler, who directed Black Panther, is an Oakland native. Zendaya is an Oakland native. There's like a bunch of people who are on the rise in Hollywood who came from
here. On the rise from Oakland.
Who came from here and are not forgetting. You know, like Zendaya like bought out the Grand Lake Theater and did a screening of Black Panther when it came out, like even though she's not in that movie. And there have been great screenings, local screenings of these various movies. And I just really appreciate these filmmakers not forgetting the community they came from. But I would really recommend Sorry to Bother You and Blind Spotting sort of equally. Sorry to Bother You is maybe like a slightly like lighter, even though it's quite dark time at the movies, but they're both great films. Neil, what did you want to say about these movies?
I've seen these movies. Well, actually, have I seen Blindspotting yet? I don't. I saw Sorry to Bother You, loved it. I'm super into the whole Oakland thing. Two reasons that we should all be in favor of this. One, I think having cities have their own like identity in film is really fun and interesting, because each city is so, especially a city like Oakland, so dynamic and different and uniquely its own. So I think that's great. It's also great to see talent, you know, coming out of different places. As someone who grew up with the greatest baseball movie ever being made about his own city, the movie Major League, it's great. It's civic pride. I like it.
I didn't know you were from Iowa. Field of Dreams.
Get out of here.
Okay.
Get out of here with that.
Here we go.
No, but it's great. I'm for it. That's all I had to say.
Yeah, the last thing I would say, like you're right that Oakland is like a really dynamic place, but as evidenced by like people like me moving into town, it's also rapidly gentrifying. And that is something that all three movies, even Black Panther, I think, grapple with. And And
well, yeah, I mean, people in different parts of the country have their different perspective, you know, which is important to hear.
Well, yeah, no, but I was just
like, would somebody who's lived in LA all their life necessarily make a movie about gentrification?
Right, and but I think I'm trying to agree with you, and just to say that like these filmmakers really trying to dig into what made the Oakland of their youth so interesting is an attempt from these people to hold on to Oakland's identity in the face of gentrification as like Silicon Valley continues to spread north. And so many people I know are getting priced out of the Bay Area altogether. Mm-hmm. And certainly a lot of residents in Oakland and like some of the browner sections of San Francisco. And so, you know, it's like Oakland has its own identity, but it's something that it feels like we're losing as like, you know, the Warriors go to San Francisco and like, the Raiders are going to Vegas, and like, not that we are our sports teams, but there's just like a lot that's like changing about this town. And so, it's nice to have these films, really try to dig into what, made these towns great to begin with. Make nice. Oakland great again is my point.
Moga.
Yeah, Moga.
No, if you add an O.
It sounds like a knockoff keyboard festival.
If you say make our Oakland great again, then it's Muga, which I think is much more fun.
Moogfest.
Then you just get sued by Moogfest.
Okay, Dave, I also want to hear about yours because I'm curious as to what the hell that is.
Yeah, so I cherry picked something out of Comic-Con because when I first heard the news that they were bringing Invader Zim back for a TV movie as a push of Nickelodeon Viacom bringing back there's some of their classic animated properties as movies. There's going to be a Hey Arnold movie and a Rocko's Modern Life TV special as well with the original cast. But we got some footage from Comic-Con for Invader Zim, Enter the Florpus. There's not of the any a dialogue from the original voice actors, even though all the original voice actors are back. Instead, it's just a montage over the songs, or the old show's theme song. Invader Zim was a show on Nickelodeon from like 2001 to 2002. It was the brainchild of a black and white comic book artist named Jonan Vasquez. To be truth, this was long enough ago in the late 90s that I've only like adapted to reading his name in print. Anyway, point being, he was somebody that did a whole bunch of alternate comics in the late 90s, early 2000s. A lot of them black and white. Johnny the Homicidal Maniac was probably the one that was the most popular in my like high school days. It's about being a it was like American Psycho before American Psycho, and but in the age of when comics were still being sort of, you could produce an indie comic entirely by yourself and it wasn't necessarily out of the norm if a big publisher picked you up. So it's really sketchy looking, and it's, I think, a really personal exploration of like a young teenage boy's power struggle with, I don't know, hormones and his own power in the world. That being said, it was really weird that they picked him up to do Invader Zim on Nickelodeon, because nothing about his comics made me think that it would translate over to a Nicktoon in any sort of way. But surprisingly, all that was left over were the actual quirky things about Vasquez, since apparently he was capable of growing out of whatever made him popular. And so you get weird jokes about, like, pigs and pizza, but really it's a whole bunch of oddball characters living in this town while Zim, the shortest invader, is supposed to be prepping the planet for invasion. And apparently the plot of the movie, as we learned at Comic-Con, is that he learns that his invaders are never coming. They just ditched him there, which is the premise of the pilot, too. Everything else in between is just sort of madcap humor. Aww, I am a mate.
Poor Zim.
I know. I'm amazed how well this show looks in HD. 2001 and 2002 was a long time ago, and I thought the show looked good then. But the adaptation of the style with like the bold lines and sort of the very colorful shading is really making the transfer over amazing. And it looks like they're choosing where to add computer effects in a very good way, which I think the original series did as well, even though it was at the turn of the century. So I'm more psyched for Enter the Florpus than I thought I was going to be. I think you guys should check out. I think you guys should check out the YouTube thing they did at Comic-Con. We still don't know when it's going to premiere, though, so I can't help you out there. Just keep an eye out.
Did you? Can you do an impression of any of the original Invader Zim voices?
Probably not. Okay. Once again, Dave turns down doing an impression on command.
Yeah.
But bingo people.
Drink.
Eventually you're going to get Mission Impossible masked into doing an impression.
Yeah, probably.
My friends used to do, I never watched Invader Zim, but my friends would do like impressions of Invader Zim. And is there a character named like Gurr? No.
There is a character. Gurr is his defective robot partner.
Yeah. Gurr. Does Gurr have a cute voice?
Yeah, Gurr has a cute voice, and he loves tacos.
What does Gurr sound like?
I see what you're doing.
All right. Someday if I win the lottery, I will pay Dave enough money to get him to do a Gurr voice.
To just faceplant in an attempt to do an impression. That's what I'm really running from. Maybe I'm really good at it. I don't know.
If you win the lottery, you have to pay Dave to sing the Great Debate song as Gurr.
Oh, man.
Because if we're going to do it, let's go all the way. Anyway,
right. So
moving on to mine.
Robot Gurr, yes.
Robot Gurr, great. I am going to go last this week, as you may have figured. We are recording this on a Tuesday, which means this Tuesday it is both hashtag International Self-Care Day and hashtag National Tequila Day. So those are two important things. Really what I wanted to talk about is sometimes it's okay to just watch something that makes you happy no matter how many times you've seen it. I found that out so last week, very busy week. My back was killing me and I was busy doing it for a project and just crazy, but we had some house guests, which also is sort of a stressful thing. You know, we had a bunch of house guests in our house. But we all bound, and these were friends of my housemates. So I know them, but I don't know them like super well. So it was great. Like at one point on Saturday, I was taking a little break from work, popped on a little Good Place. All of a sudden everybody kind of flocked into the living room and like we started talking about the Good Place and how everybody loves the Good Place. It was just really great because we spend so much of our time online. We spend so much of our time thinking sort of about the minutia of popular culture. And sometimes it's just fun to just sit back and watch something that's fun and that other people around you like.
Neil's storm chasing this week is real world interaction.
Yeah.
I don't know about that.
I've had real world interactions this week.
Yeah.
Over tequila.
Yeah.
Those are things. Dave, you had plenty of those. You went to all these weddings. We are being
social
creatures.
Right, so I would encourage
you.
I
wish my wedding showed the Good Place, though. That would have been like an extra little treat.
You know, sometimes you just gotta take a little time for some self-care and log off the old Twitter machine, and that's good. And then log back on the little Twitter machine and tweet a million things about Mission Impossible, which I also did this week.
Excellent. So we've got Invader Zim, we've got the Oakland Descents, and we've got the Good Place, and actually going out and interacting with people.
Grr. Talking to people IRL. Grr.
All right, that brings us to Mission Impossible Segment 1, which brings us from 1996 to Mission Impossible Rogue Nation over 5 amazing missions. We have some questions from the listeners to get to, but I think overall thoughts, is there some sort of greater Mission Impossible thesis that we've learned on our Mission Impossible tour? I know, Joanna, you've been doing live watches with everybody, so I know you've caught up on everything recently. So I'm going to start with Neil in hopes that this sudden question leads to podcast gold.
Well, I will say this. I had I had a thesis brewing over the last couple days that I discussed with Joanna and several others, and like good friends, they talked me out of it. So I didn't didn't bring that one to the podcast.
Wow, that was like such a sweet way you put me like bullying you out of some thesis.
No, I mean, I thought I had something, and I didn't.
And then I just like badgered you until you did.
Yeah, sometimes you don't have something, and that's what friends are for. But I will say this, having watched them in a very weird order, I watched, the first one I watched was 2. I watched it with the Slack. Then I watched Fallout. Then I went to my press screening of Fallout. Then I came home from that because I was so pumped up. Which we'll get to later, and I watched Rogue Nation and Ghost Protocol in reverse order. And then today, before we podcasted, I watched 1 and 3. A couple of thoughts. One is, it surprises me how much stuff has lived on from the original that Brian De Palma made. So, like, the opening credits being very specific. I mean, it's been a long time since I've watched any of the original show, so that's probably how it is, and they just kind of carried it over. But it is interesting to see how there are so many consistent things sort of throughout the franchise, even though they have changed directorial hands several times. I mean, we're talking Brian De Palma, John Woo, J.J. Abrams, Brad Bird, and then Christopher McQuarrie times 3.
How dare you say Brad Bird with such incredulity when he delivered the best.
Brad Bird was a very surprising choice, and, you know, he may have. I think you have a lot of good points with the Ghost Protocol being the best one. I think Fallout's in that range. But, you know, for a franchise to get handed off from director to director to director, the one thing that's holding this all together is, of course, Tom, our man Tom.
I'm sorry, you mispronounced Ving Rhames.
Well, as a creative entity, Ving Rhames shows up and delivers all the best stuff. But so it's really interesting to see a star-driven franchise that is good and getting better, continually sort of getting better at a lot of things. And you don't see that. We see a lot of stars out there who have a lot of creative control. We talked about The Rock last week. Lots of control over his world, and he's making decisions of varying quality. And I think Tom Cruise does that as well. Sort of. I mean, The Mummy. But he really nails it when it comes to Mission Impossible. He really found his sweet spot. And when you go back and you watch that first movie, I can't say that I ever saw that coming. Like, if you watch the first two Mission Impossibles sort of in a vacuum, you couldn't convince me that this franchise would be going, you know, in its sixth movie, and I'd walk out of its sixth movie and be like, yeah, I'm ready for like 6 more of those. So it is interesting. Through sheer force of will, Tom Cruise has sort of made this into his, you know, his thing, and it's great. But what's interesting about it too is they tried to do that with The Mummy. They tried to like create this like whole universe, and that failed, and I can't quite figure out why yet. Maybe that's the bigger question that I'm trying to answer. But yeah, so those are my thoughts on the Mission Impossible franchise as it stands currently.
Interesting. Joanna, contributions? Greater theses?
I have many great theses. So I think the original Mission Impossible, which is a good movie, is like an interesting sort of attempt, and this... In the 90s, there was an attempt to sort of like take these 70s. What was the original Mission Impossible? 70s, right?
60s or 70s.
60s or 70s.
Maybe.
TV shows and like turn them into movies. Like The Saint is one and stuff like that. And I think that functions well as that. And then what it grew into is something completely unexpected. And I think you see it flailing around for a while. Like the John Woo installment is a real mistake and really doesn't understand what made the first one good. And then as it goes on, it's sort of, I think Brad Bird is the one in Ghost Protocol who really drilled down on what makes Mission Impossible movies so compelling. And what it is there's a line in Fallout, and this is not a spoiler, there's a line in Fallout that a character sees Tom Cruise doing something insane and says, like, I think this crazy motherfucker is trying to, like, something. And, like, I won't say the something because that's a spoiler. And I'm like, yeah, that's what these movies are. It's Tom Cruise almost killing himself over and over and over again and going, are you not entertained? And that's what the Mission Impossible movies are. And that's why Ghost Protocol is my favorite, because it actually has the least plot around the various stunts. It's just like MacGuffin, like not really a villain. No emotional stakes really for Tom Cruise. He's just accomplishing things and it's beautiful. And that's why I think Ghost Protocol is the most successful for me. And then Chris McQuarrie comes on board for Rogue Nation and then Fallout. And Rogue Nation and Fallout also have hugely impressive stunts. Fallout is one of the craziest things I've ever seen in my entire life. And we'll get to that. But McQuarrie has also put back in a lot of the plot stuff. And it works better than like Mission Impossible 2, which was this like stupid love story between Tandy Newton and Tom Cruise, where Tandy Newton's completely wasted. Or Mission Impossible 3, where you're trying to do a love story again with a marriage this time. And that, like, those things just don't really work. But when it's just like Ethan Hunt is a crazy dude with a death wish who's trying to save the world, that's what the Mission Impossible movies, like, that's what you get such a thrill, or that's what I get such a thrill out of. And I know some people are trying to rank Rogue Nation and Fallout above Ghost Protocol because they think the character work in those movies do elevate them. But I, like, I found myself impatient occasionally in both Rogue Nation and Fallout, being like, Okay. A twist, a double cross, or like whatever. Can you get to the next thing where Tom Cruise almost dies? Because that's really fun for me to watch, and that's what I want to be watching. So my theses are that, and this is co-opting a thing that David Ehrlich has said that I've often disagreed with, which is that like occasionally it's good for a film to be like deeply unconcerned with its human characters. You know, David used that in reference to Godzilla. I find Godzilla like deeply boring. The Gareth Edwards Godzilla, that's like where I first heard David Ehrlich talking about this idea that like you can have a movie where like the humans don't matter and that's okay. And I just violently disagreed with him when it came to Godzilla, but I kind of agree with him when it comes to the Mission Impossible movies. And then the last thing I'll say is, and this is where you get like, please have your drink ready, because you're gonna like, if you're playing the Storm Spoilers drinking game, you're gonna drink. There is one of the most impressive podcast episodes I've ever listened to is Chris McQuarrie giving an interview with Chris Hewitt of the Empire podcast. The episode is almost 3 hours long. And it's just the two of them talking about making Rogue Nation, but also about the process of making a film with Tom Cruise. Because McQuarrie came on to do rewrites on Ghost Protocol, and then he worked on Rogue Nation, he worked on Fallout. And he and Tom Cruise have worked together on Valkyrie, on Jack Reacher, on Edge of Tomorrow. So he's sort of like he won an Oscar for writing The Usual Suspects. And so like he has like a shorthand. He talks about how he and Tom Cruise don't even speak to each other in complete sentences at this point. They have this like sympathy where they just like understand each other. And he talked about the way in which, and we're going to talk about all the problems with Tom Cruise and why his like problematic personhood makes at least one of us, if not all of us, like deeply conflicted about enjoying these movies. But what I will say that I was surprised to learn from this podcast interview on the Empire Network is that the way in which Tom Cruise has like a really strong sense of storytelling, and how Chris McQuarrie tells one anecdote about how they were getting really bad reaction to the ending of Rogue Nation. People felt like there was too many endings, and they were like, in their test screenings, people were really reacting really poorly to it. And Tom Cruise, like, you know, listened to the note, and then he goes, we don't, and, you know, so they were going to cut a bunch of stuff. And he's like, you know, we don't have to cut anything. Let's just change the music. And they just changed the music, and then they tested it again, and it scored super well. And so that's like an example that Chris McQuarrie gave of like the things that Tom Cruise will do, or like the other things that Tom Cruise will insist upon that you'll be surprised by. Like, it's a Tom Cruise rule and now a Chris McQuarrie rule that the woman is never the damsel in distress. So they said they learned that from Emily Blunt on Edge of Tomorrow. Rad. So Ilsa Faust is never the damsel in distress. And that's like something that the Mission Impossible franchise, like, had a real problem with its female characters in the beginning, really, I think, got it right in Ghost Protocol, which McQuarrie worked on, and got it right in these last two as well, I think. And so, I don't know, I'm just fascinated by this idea of Tom Cruise as like a, like an, almost like a, like having like Rain Man-esque ability to have like a sense of story, you know?
He's like a savant.
Yeah, he's a savant when it comes to like certain kinds of storytelling beats. He talks about Rogue Nation as like a romance where like the opera is their first date, and like the first fight is boy meets girl, and then the opera is their first date, and then the motorcycle chase is like boy loses girl, and like all this other stuff like that. Like, that's fascinating to me. And the way in which they cobble these movies together, like they were like, oh, and a bunch of different versions of Rogue Nation, the stunt that starts it was going to end it, but we decided to keep it at the beginning. And it's like the fact that like we almost made it a post-credit sequence. And like the fact that they like have these elements that they could just slide in and out means that the movie should be terrible, but it's not. And so I don't know. I'm just really impressed by these movies generally. And I'm a huge fan of the last three installments of the franchise. Huge, huge fan.
Yeah. And, you know, it comes back to the, I think, the sort of like default line on Tom Cruise is like, whatever we think about him as a person.
I get a lot of thoughts, for sure.
The one truth, there's a universal truth of Tom Cruise, and it's that he cares the most about you having a good time watching his movies. Like, he will do whatever it takes to impress you in his movies. And I think that is a valuable quality to have in an action star. So now, Dave, we can talk about the rest of Tom Cruise.
Oh, I mean, we don't have to get that too far into it. I don't like Tom Cruise.
But he's weird. Like, as a person, he's weird. And Scientology's
weird. He's
weird,
and he advocates for a lot of things with his pulpit, or did at least in the past, that is borderline dangerous, including maybe his religion. But that's absolutely fine. People could seek out those answers on their own.
I think Tom Cruise is mentally unwell in many regards. And
yes,
for me, that somewhat actually enhances the Ethan Hunt performance, because I believe Ethan Hunt is mentally unwell in many regards. And so, like, I mean, I don't know. I don't want to be glib about, well, I didn't even mean to make that a Tom Cruise reference, but that's a very famous Tom Cruise interaction with Matt Lauer. Anyway, like, I don't want to be glib about mental health, but like the way in which Tom Cruise seems like unhinged, especially that time in his life where he like drew back the curtain and let people sort of see himself before he retreated back to like privacy and obscurity. I mean, sort of like not obscurity, but like, you know, obscuring who he is. That death wish that I see in Ethan Hunt, that aligns to me with like someone who would jump on Oprah's couch. You know what I mean? It just seems similar to me. Someone who would climb the Burj Khalifa is someone who would jump on a couch. And so way, it's not incongruous for me to watch this imbalanced person risk life and limb for whatever in the Mission movies, because I believe it's something that like Tom Cruise himself would do, and does do, because he insists on doing these stunts himself.
I think there's just like there's a part of his personality, for better and for worse, that is always sort of on as a showman. So I think that works great when he's making movies. And I think that it has had very, very mixed results when it comes to like things he wants to do in his personal life, and things he believes, you know, or really, and a lot of it sort of revolves around Scientology. But I think when there seems to be a point in his life, I'm thinking like probably after post Katie Holmes, like in the last, like, you know, 8 to 10 years here, where he's sort of made, it looks like he's made a conscious decision to be less of a showman in his personal life and more of just let the movies be what they are, which I think we talked about this with The Rock last week, where it's like, that's kind of what we want from The Rock. And I think it's okay to be thankful that Tom Cruise has made that decision, because otherwise he would be probably someone who's way harder to like.
Yeah. I think the thing that always brings me back to the Mission Impossible franchise is I had three movies that I think brought me in for various reasons, pre me knowing everything I needed to know about Tom Cruise. The first one is like a Brian De Palma movie that happens to be a Mission Impossible movie. It feels like it as it's going through its Spycraft paces, even though they were kind of riding it as they were going on. It, you know, feels De Palma-y. The Black Dahlia feels very similar to Mission Impossible, even though it's years later. So I always sort of think that Mission Impossible is not only the start of a franchise, but it also takes a lot from the TV show and kind of smashes it up against Brian De Palma's sensibilities as a director. So I liked that movie just existing as it was, and when it came out, I liked it because it was kind of a thinker in comparison to something like The Saint, which Joanna brought up earlier, which, you know, has Elizabeth Shue. So I guess pluses and minuses to everything.
And Cold Fusion.
The second movie's ridiculous, but it was one of the first movies I went on with, like, one of the first dates I went on with, like, my first serious girlfriend. And I was so nervous about, like, going on this date that the movie kind of burned parts of itself into my mind. Which is to say that I didn't realize how horrible it was until I revisited it. And then I was like, oh, this is like, everything that was wrong with like late 90s action movies is on display right here in one film as like sort of like an educational purpose. So it was a great way to bring in, you know, the next decade of action movies, but everything that like got left over and chopped up by the pre-Matrix world got like spit out in Impossible 2. In like some Mission Impossible 2 in some sort of like non-recognizable form. The way it treats, I guess, Ethan Hunt as an action star from the very first frame of the movie, even though he doesn't necessarily do a bunch of cool things, by like framing his shots in certain ways, really just it's like, yeah, everything I didn't like about only the bad parts of John Woo movies slammed together. Three is J.J. Abrams trying to reboot something. He's like, hey, it's about the team, which I remember being the sales pitch about it when it was coming out. It's like, we're going to reorient these movies around the team. Mission Impossible was always about the team, except that he makes it about Ethan Hunt and a mystery box, which is fine. It's a J.J. Abrams movie, much like the first three movies, or the other two movies of the first trilogy stick around their directors. Then we have this gap after these movies before Rogue Nation comes out, and what happens is James Bond reboots itself to be about James Bond, and the second that happens, Mission Impossible realizes it shouldn't be about Ethan Hunt because the James Bond hole is open. The James Bond formula is you start a movie with a gigantic stunt that has no connection to anything else. James Bond comes back, checks in, gets his mission, meets the girl, does a whole bunch of crazy shit while hopping all over the world, and then it all wraps up beautifully. And that's what the final three Mission Impossible films are. I'm assuming I didn't get to see Fallout, not because of my Tom Cruise boycott, simply because of scheduling mishaps. But I do plan to see Fallout, and I'm expecting it to be the James Bond that comes back. And I was always a fan of James Bond. As a child, it used to be the thing, like, we would go to Blockbuster, and I would spend my summers with three other boys, and each one would get, like, a James Bond movie, so we had, like, four James Bond movies for, like, 4 days, and we'd mainline all the James Bond movies, and then we were in, I don't know, like, middle school, and they're like, oh, it's coming back, and here's Pierce Brosnan, he's, like, the new James Bond movie, and then we got GoldenEye, which was a great James Bond spy movie with a, you know, a big stunt to start off the beginning, but then actually some interesting villains instead of what we were used to with James Bond. And then that sort of deteriorated as the action movie sort of had to become something else and became sort of this Jason Bourne, late Mission Impossible, amorphous blob. And now, since we've decided that Daniel Craig's James Bond is going to be in continuity and we're going to learn some stuff about him, that has freed Mission Impossible up to be the franchise that's like, oh, you don't want continuity? You just want crazy-ass stunts and globe-hopping? Yeah. Well, here's a franchise for you.
On the one hand, we're going to talk about Fallout, and on the one hand, like, Fallout, I thought, I like Mission Impossible in its current iteration more than I like the Bond franchise, but it definitely is American Bond. and exactly what you're saying, Dave. And this one, in many respects, is like one of the bondiest things I've ever seen. There's like a big stunt at the end that, as I was watching, I was like, this is the most fucking Bond thing ever. Not just because the guy next to me was like incessantly clicking his pen, which always makes me think of GoldenEye, but like there's a stunt that is so Bond and would so clearly be like a video game if this were like a different time. But at the same time, this is the movie that actually returns brings continuity to Mission Impossible. The Fallout weaves in like all the previous installments in a way that I'm not sure that I loved, to be honest with you. So they're like, so much was made about Rebecca Ferguson being the first, kind of technically the first, even though Michelle Monaghan kind of repeated, but the first like female star of a mission movie to come back. But then they also brought Michelle Monaghan back in a big way and like just made, yeah, that continuity feel more important. And then in that, you know, Alec Baldwin is back, like, you know, like you didn't have repeating directors before, you didn't have this sort of stuff. And so, yeah, it just feels more continuous in a way that I don't like. And I wish it did more of what you're saying, Dave, which is just like, here's another thing that where Ethan Hunt is going to climb something and throw himself off something and someone's going to wear a mask, you know?
Right. I'll be interested to hear later on in this episode just how much that stuff manages to land, or if it's like hanging decorations on a Christmas tree just to like give it the illusion of completion. I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see when and if this wraps up, how they choose to do it, if they decide to, you know, just recast an Ethan Hunt or give it to a side character, which brings us to our first listener question. Question from Lyad? Lyad? L-Y-A-D?
I think it's I-Y-A-D, actually.
Is it?
In the Slack, yeah.
Oh.
It's capital I that looks like an L. I get it.
My bad.
There we go. Who should take over the franchise when Tom Cruise retires, or should it not go on without him? Neil?
I mean, you guys just mentioned Rebecca Ferguson, who is the first, is sort of the, Michelle Monaghan does come back, but she's not what I would consider to be a primary character in any of the films. In fact, now that I know what fridging is, I know that that's exactly what happened in Mission Impossible 3. But I'm taking Ilsa. I'm taking Rebecca Ferguson because I think that.
And Go to Call.
Yes, yes.
But a dude gets fridged and Go to Call.
Who gets fridged and Go to Call?
Well, no. Sawyer before gets before fridged. It. Oh, I
oh,
mean,
oh yeah,
that,
reverse fridging. This
that
franchise
happens,
has
but
it
then
all.
Also Michelle Monaghan's fake death is used as the entire
oh,
plot
right.
point
for Jeremy Renner's both. Character.
Yeah, for Jeremy Renner's character.
But she's not.
Okay, so double fridge, not great.
But she's not. One and a half fridges.
One and yeah. a half. But I'm taking Rebecca Ferguson's character because I think she's awesome. Here's the thing that I like about Rebecca Ferguson that's super underrated. There's a moment in the first movie that she's in, which is, and I'm going to do this throughout the entire podcast, forget which movie is which. It's
Three.
Rogue Nation.
Rebecca Ferguson, Rogue Nation, yes.
Yes. Okay. So there's a scene in Rogue Nation, the one where Tom Cruise is being going to be tortured and she beats up those dudes, that is perhaps one of the most violent things I've ever seen a female character do in a big action franchise. Like, she delivers, and we're going to talk about this with Tom Cruise, where it's like you kind of feel it. Holy shit. She's awesome. Like, you really feel it when she's kicking the crap out of these random Serbians or whatever they are.
Yeah, and she gets punched in the back of the head like 5 times while Ethan's trying to get his shit together.
Right.
Well, the thing I like is that Ethan is the damsel in distress in that scene. He's the one
yeah.
to pick up.
She's no yeah. joke, and I think a series, you know, because I think we can agree, I guess, that Tom Cruise is not immortal, maybe. But I think if the series had to carry on, it would be great to see Rebecca Ferguson sort of take over. I think they wanted Jeremy Renner to be that character, and he's just not.
Well, they did. They planned to have Jeremy Renner take over the franchise, just like they planned to have him take over the Bourne franchise. And then it was just sort of like Ghost Protocol wasn't working. And the one place in Ghost Protocol where it drags is that whole part in the middle where it stops and like Jeremy Renner's like, so I was assigned to like protect this right. dude and his wife. Like you're like, I don't give a shit. Why is it Tom falling off something?
Yeah, why are we caring about like the fourth most interesting person on the team?
So I mean, I actually really loved Renner in Protocol and like his other stuff. Like he gets good comedic stuff. I love him in in Protocol and Rogue Nation, that's some of like Renner's finest work, actually, I think. But
the stretching's great.
The stretching's so good. He's just really funny, or like the trying to catch the train, like all of that stuff. That's when Macquarie was brought on, and like Macquarie was just sort of like, no, it's about Tom. You know what I mean? Like Macquarie's Tom's guy, and he got brought on, and he was like, no, this franchise is about Tom, and it needs to be about Tom. And so like the Ghost Protocol got recentered on Tom in a way that it wasn't before. It was like sort of a passing of the torch, and yeah, and so like Renner got like a sidelined.
It was a passing of the torch from Tom to himself.
Yeah, and then Renner got kind of sidelined a bit in Rogue Nation, and then is just not in Fallout, which is a bummer. I would have loved to see him in Fallout, but
he was too busy not being in Infinity War.
Yeah, also not being in Infinity War. The year like the that
Jeremy Renner, Jeremy Renner, yeah, not being in movies.
I thought about Ilsa, like when this question first came up, I was like, should it be Ilsa? But like, the thing is, Ilsa's not like crazy. And like, Ethan Hunt is crazy. And like, okay.
Right. They'd have to do something to make her crazy.
Yeah. Cause she's not, she can beat the shit out of people. So she'd be in her own franchise where she beats the shit out of people. Like the Haywire We Always Wanted or something like that. Like that would be great. But like, it's not going to be Mission Impossible. Cause like, she's not going to be like throwing herself off stuff. That's
it
not
makes me kind of wish that, and I tweeted this, of course, that Josh Holloway would have lasted a little longer because like, smooth Southern Ethan Hunt is something sure. I could get behind.
Yeah, maybe that character can have a twin.
Yeah, bring him back as a twin.
Yeah, sure.
But and like, then he and Ilsa can team up after to avenge Ethan Hunt, who dies spectacularly because Tom Cruise died in real life trying to do a stunt.
I just can't, like, my answer, and spoiler alert, my answer is the same as Dave's answers, which is like, I just can't think of anyone who can bring what Tom brings, which is not to say Tom Cruise is the best actor in the world or the best whatever, but he is so uniquely Tom Cruise. And what, and as Neil mentioned, Tom Cruise's number one mission is to like entertain you. And if he has to break every bone in his body in order to do that, he's going to do that. And I can't think of any other actor working right now.
Ooh, you know who might be able to pull off that kind of crazy? Mm. Ezra Miller.
Sure. But that's like he's a scrawny fella.
He could get bigger. He could work out.
Sure.
Tom has gone through some physical changes throughout the franchise.
It's true. It's true.
I kind of knew that this was going to end up with everyone saying it shouldn't go on because that actually is the reasonable answer. So I'm reaching.
reason I say it shouldn't go on is just like it's already a James Bond clone. There will be another. Of what these things are. I don't think there's any reason to force it to be under the banner Mission Impossible. It could be any of these actors or actresses that have appeared before and made their, you know, bones in being a side character in an action movie. But I would like to see like a character that's focused around that, because I think we saw, what is it? The 24 did Someone's so mad because they think Jack Bauer is done. She crosses the line. Jack Bauer was always crossing and becomes the female Jack Bauer. And I'm like, I don't know if we need to see that. Just let there be a female James Bond or whatever, and it needs to be on its own. We don't need to.
Let's just watch the Atomic Blonde 2 and Charlize.
Speaking of
Charlize, here, I have a quick
the
I have
business
a quick question.
Kicked out of her. Yeah.
Quick question, follow up on this, which I think might actually be a more interesting question, which is.
Oh, sorry, I didn't see that, Dave. Sorry.
How many more do you think they'll do? Like, when I was walking in the theater, I was like, I hope they get to 10. Like, I hope they do 4 more of these. How many more Mission Impossibles do you think they'll
so
will have?
So tired in this movie. Doesn't
but
he look
he actually,
so tired in this movie?
He looks very tired, but he also looks like he's probably in the best shape he's been in since the franchise began.
It's an amazing combination. I say they should do two more.
So you're saying eight total. Eight's a good... I mean, I feel like Fast and Furious is going to blow by that pretty quickly. And
well, they've already done their eight. Mission eight possible. That's what I... Mission Impossible, let's come
Space
up with
Space Force.
Space Force, there it is.
spoiler for another question.
All right. Yeah, that was going to be my answer for how many more Mission Impossible movies where Tom Cruise literally goes to space, which was a question from Ryan.
Yeah.
And I say two, because there's going to be two more, and the last one's in space.
And Tom Cruise actually gets to go to space.
Right. I think it's like that's the big thing, because like at that point it's more about like, can the physical human body go through it? He's literally at the limit where like it's science, it's not will.
I'm just going to keep
Can we send you into space at this age?
I'm just going to keep citing this McQuarrie interview because I would apologize for it, but except it's really great information. One thing he was talking to Chris Hewitt about was like, yeah, what other stunts can they do? And the thing that he said Tom Cruise is so adamant about is that like Tom Cruise really needs to know you, the audience. He really needs you, the audience, to know that he is doing this himself. So it's not so like Chris Hewitt was just kind of like spitballing, and he's like, "What if you put like a poisonous, you know, anaconda down his pants or something like that?" And then McQuarrie's like, "Yeah, but how do you know it's his pants? How do you know that we haven't defanged the anaconda? How do you know like these are the questions Tom will ask anytime you propose a stunt?" And he's like, "Okay, but how does the audience know, you know, that we didn't cheat this, that we didn't cheat that?" And so when you watch Fallout, knowing that, or any of them, but like especially Fallout, I was watching like thinking about that, and like you watch how the camera, like they'll use these long shots where the camera, you know, is on Tom's face, and then it'll like follow his body doing something, and it will come back to Tom's face, and they're like, "No, really, this is Tom doing this. There is no way someone else is doing this. Tom did throw himself out of a plane. Tom did ride that motorcycle around Paris. Tom did do all of this stuff." And like the camera is working so hard to make sure that you know that there's no, I mean, sure, there's some CG trickery, but like there's for the most part not CG trickery in doing this.
I think it tricks your subconscious, because it's like consciously I know that Tom Cruise is safe and he lives and it's fine, but subconsciously I'm having a panic attack the entire time.
Fallout was one of the most stressful movie viewing experiences.
It's so stressful, and it's unreasonable stress, because it's like I'm watching a movie, but it's so well done that you're just like, shit, he's gonna fall.
Yeah. He's going to break all his bones.
He's going to die. Like, I'm about to watch Tom Cruise die, even though I know he's alive, I think.
Is it like Westworld and they just have like a closet of Tom Cruises and they just like kill some and then they just activate the next one? Is that what's going on?
I mean, it's a more logical explanation than what's really happening, so.
Should we roll to our next question?
Hell yeah.
Let's kind of lightning round these so we could get you guys to talk more about Fallout. Yeah. All right. What's your dream Mission Impossible director after McQuarrie leaves the franchise, assuming it goes on? Neil.
I'm going Reed Morano, not necessarily as a specific fit for Mission Impossible, but because I want to see Reed Morano direct a big action franchise, and she has a wonderful eye. So I think that is another hallmark of the Mission Impossible series, is that they've gotten like Rob Hardy, who also did Ex Machina and other similar movies, had shot this one. Robert Elswit, who's just like a legend, shot the other ones. I'd love to see someone with that kind of eye take the director's chair, and real, you know, who knows? It might work with Tom. It's hard to know, because it's like, whoever is the Tom Whisperer. So it's like, maybe Chris McQuarrie should just stay on until the end.
Yeah, do a David Yates and do it for the rest of his life. I'm going to go with David Leitch, the director of Atomic Blonde and more recently Deadpool 2, specifically because Deadpool 2's hand-to-hand combat choreography is much better than that movie needs it to be. And assuming that Tom Cruise goes on and continues to age, I think a good way to allow Mission Impossible's action to continue to shine would be to do more close-up choreography in those styles, like an Atomic Blonde or like a Deadpool truck scene.
Or even like a Bourne movie.
Exactly, like a Bourne movie. So you get a little bit of that, and then, you know, only shoot Tom Cruise into space for the non-combat scenes.
And my answer was to bring Bad Bird back, because the as much as I like Chris McQuarrie, I think he's amazing. The action in Ghost Protocol is so clean and so clear. And I would really like Brad Bird to come back and do more Mission Impossible movies.
Who would be on your Impossible Mission team? Let's say you have to pick three to go with Tom, Joanna.
Oh, hey, I cheated.
We're gonna let you go last in case you wanna tighten that list up a little bit.
I'm not gonna. Nope.
Oh, all right, Neil. Before Joanna takes all the choices, why don't you go first?
This is off brand for me, but I'm gonna follow the rules. I'm taking Paula Patton because she is super tough in that movie. It's frighteningly tough. Simon Pegg because Benji's a really great, useful dude, and you know what? Benji is the okay guy. Like, Benji will say okay to anything Ethan Hunt has him do. He's been almost blown up like a million times. So I'm taking Benji because you need that dude who's ride or die all the way. And then Rebecca Ferguson, for similar reasons as Paula Patton, is just like, she just kicks a lot of ass. So it's like, if you get into a scrap, you need some help. You know, so the two women and then the guy who will literally just sit on a bomb for you. It's fine.
I'm also going to take Rebecca Ferguson because that's the MVP if you're actually going to survive your impossible mission. Kerry Russell, because she seems really dedicated, guys. She's going to do it. She's going to do it at the cost of her own life. And then Emilio Estevez, because quack.
Can I just say really quickly before I get to my cheating answer that, like, when we were watching the first Mission Impossible, and spoiler alert, Emilio Estevez dies at the beginning on this great, memorable elevator scene. He dies because the elevator's going up and there are these, like, spike things coming down. And someone said for the first time, I've seen that movie a bunch of times, I've never thought about this. Someone was like, what purpose do those spike things serve when they're not skewering Emilio Estevez? Like, why are there spikes at the top of that elevator shaft? Okay. My cheating answer is I'm going to do a rogues gallery of the ladies. Say Paula Patton, Kristen Scott Thomas, Maggie Q, who is not used very well in Mission Impossible 3. Undead Kerry Russell, so she'll be a zombie. It'll be great. Rebecca Ferguson, obviously. Tandy Newton, used even worse in Mission Impossible 2. She will be her badass self. And then Simon Pegg, because, you know, just bring him.
The
bring
only him one of those that I would push back on is undead Kerry Russell, because I would not be able to not look at her eye that is all
fucked
up.
Yeah, the wonk eye.
Yeah, couldn't do it.
It would be great, though. You would put her in the field, people would be like, oh my God, what happened to Felicity? Oh, no.
This is bad. What did you do in the Star Wars?
It's a good question.
From Josh, in which film does Ethan Hunt have the best hair, Joanna?
I'm going to say Mission Impossible 2. When we were watching it in the live watch in the Patreon, we decided that it was the Rachel from Friends era. And it is, if you look at it. So, yeah, Tom Cruise is rocking the Rachel, Mission Impossible 2.
I'm going to say Go to Call, just because I feel like it's
really good
amount
hair.
Of hair, so you could tell which direction the wind is blowing in any situation, but not in too much hair, like maybe number two.
Is that a sandstorm coming? Check Tom's hair. Tom's hair says yes, the sandstorm is coming.
The wind changed. Neil?
I'm going with him in Fallout, because it's a little tighter and a little more utilitarian, but also still has some of the very similar effects. And he also, as we talked about before we started recording, his hair looks really great disheveled in Fallout, because as Joanna has mentioned, he's very tired in that movie. He's very over it, and he's very snarky, and it's the funniest he's been. So I'm going with the new one, with Fallout.
All right, and last question from James. What franchise would you like to see this crossover with? I'd like to see a crossover with Fast and Furious, mainly because I feel having Tom Cruise on set doing his own stunts would force the Maso Cash of Fast and Furious up their game, which is funny. But, Neil, what did you pick?
I'm going with the Da Vinci Code franchise, the Dan Brown universe. One, because I think it'd be fun to inject Tom Hanks and his hair into this franchise. But also there's a lot of, especially in the last couple of movies, Christopher McQuarrie seems to be very interested in sort of both religious fanaticism and anti-religious fanaticism. And there's a lot of interesting ideas there. I mean, basically, like, you know, there's a whole group of bad guys who are, like, militant atheists, essentially. And I think it would be interesting to, like, cross over into this world in which the church has so much power and sort of run those ideas against each other and see what happens. So also, he could do the Vatican. He could do a bunch of Vatican stunts again. It'd be great.
Joanna.
Mine is, well, I said Ocean's 8, but really any of the Ocean's movies, because I just want to sort of see, like, two heists kind of crash into each other, and just sort of, like, mid-heist, it's like, oh, wait, why is Brad Pitt snacking, and why is Cate Blanchett here in an amazing suit? Like, whatever. So mix and match your Ocean's people in the middle of a Mission Impossible heist as well. So.
Okay. I took that need, but then distilled it to its core. And I'm saying make Duplicity 2 a Mission Impossible movie. So you have Clive Owens, MI6 agent, and Julia Roberts, CIA agent, run across the Mission Impossible force. And it's like sort of like it's Duplicity 2, Mission Impossible 7, we're getting too old for this
shit.
Oh,
I was super confused when I read this. What was that movie with Michael Keaton where he clones himself?
Multiplicity.
I thought you meant clone Tom Cruise.
Oh,
it's all about the team, and the team is all Tom Cruise.
And the team is all Cruise.
Or there's like another team that is clones, but they're evil, and they all have mustaches.
Shouldn't it then... So if Mission Impossible 8 is Space Wars, should Mission Impossible 7 be Cruise Control? Where it's just cruises?
Well, but then we... See, then we... No, that... Because then we don't know
well, then we
if that's
need
the
9
real
and 10
Tom
to
shot
it
in
up.
The space. If we ever do the clone ones, it has to be the last one, so we know that Tom Cruise did all the stunts. Otherwise,
no
it could
wires.
Just be a clone. Exactly. That all makes sense in its own
totally
weird,
makes sense.
Jokey whatnot. Let's move on. Guys, tell me about Mission Impossible Fallout.
Pew, 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 pew.
Pew, pew, pew.
Dave.
And, yeah.
You should definitely see this movie, because it's...
Definitely.
Amazeballs. It's really great. I would say... I made the joke on Twitter. It was obviously a joke that it was one Limp Bizkit song away from being the perfect Mission Impossible movie.
Ayo.
I've since changed my tone that this is the most Mission Impossible movie. Like, there's just there's like everything you like about it cranked to like 11. Whereas I think Joanna, who is, spoiler alert, about to tell us why Ghost Protocol is still better, is right about Ghost Protocol being maybe a better movie. But I think this one, like, there is not an action franchise, and I say this having seen all of the Fast and Furious movies, that goes to insane lengths to make us impressed with what it's doing other than Mission Impossible. Mission Impossible is the pinnacle of that, and this has the most of that.
So
I loved it.
Yeah. So I was watching it, and I was like, you know, so the New York screening was like, what, last week or something like that. And everyone was like, jerk off motion is the best movie ever. And I was like, okay, it's going to be the best movie ever. And I go in and I was like, no, it's not good as Ghost Protocol. I'm not even sure it's as good as Rogue Nation. That was like halfway through. And then there were like 9 more stunts left to go. And I was like, never mind. It's bludgeoned me into submission. This is definitely better than Rogue Nation.
It really
Nation.
Does beat you down.
It just beats you down because, like, let's, Neil, can we play a game right now where we try to list all of the stunts? Let's go back and forth. I'm going to start.
Okay.
I don't remember what's first, so I'm just going to pick jumping out of the airplane into the lightning storm.
Oh, man, that happens.
Yeah.
There was one before that. What did they open
I know,
on?
I just can't remember what opens.
Oh, not really. They open with them, he shoots, nope, that's Rogue Nation. Don't remember how Fallout opens. Saw it yesterday. There is the helicopter chase. That's an easy one.
Okay,
big helicopter chase. Where
helicopter chase is insane. Okay,
this is like 30 minutes long, and it's all awesome.
Motorcycle chase through Paris.
The motorcycle chase is amazing. There is also a car chase, right? Yes.
Which car?
There's
chase?
A motorcycle chase, and then there's the car get in the car.
The truck chase. Oh
yes.
No! There's the truck chase. And then there's the small BMW chase. Okay, I'm counting those two separate
things. They lead to each other. So there's a scene which is basically about them breaking that dude out of police custody where they push a truck into a river.
Sure.
And then there's an underwater sequence. And then there's a motorcycle chase. And then there's a motorcycle plus a car chase.
Yeah.
Which all feel like three different things. But I guess when you really think about it, they're all one thing.
That's fine. Okay. Tom Cruise runs on the rooftops and lands and ends at the on the roof, goes up an elevator, dangling on the bottom of the elevator, and winds up on the roof of the Tate Modern. That's another one.
Yeah, which if you try to convince me that there are two running sequences across rooftops, I would believe you.
It goes on for a very long time. bathroom fight.
Bathroom fight is awesome.
Bathroom fight in Paris. So that's seven.
Rebecca it's really like for the Henry Cavill fans out there, the bathroom fight is the peak. Like that's the best Henry Cavill you get.
It's amazing.
It's amazing. He's actually really good in this movie. I liked Henry Cavill in this movie. I think he should play the Terminator. Though, like that's where this movie leads me. It's like, let's do Henry Cavill as a Terminator. Don't talk, just punch.
Is that it? That might be it.
Well, and then they go into the club, and there's a sequence in the like dapper club where he is slowly
Vanessa
walking
Kirby
Vanessa Kirby out of the room while people are trying to stab her, and it's like weirdly calm.
Yeah.
So that
I'm trying to think
great.
Of all the people that Rebecca Ferguson takes down with her legs. I think we covered
it's
it
a
all
lot
though.
Of people.
Anyway,
yeah.
it's like it's crazy. That's eight.
Oh, there's the fight scene in the house with Sean, what's his name, the villain? Sean Harris, Simon Pegg, and Rebecca Ferguson, where she and Sean Harris beat the shit out of each other.
So
which is
good.
Awesome.
Nine. That's nine. Okay. So anyway, it's like the incredible, like just when you think like you've seen enough, there's more. The helicopter. Oh, well, the helicopter thing then leads into this like cliff fight. The helicopter thing
is also like three parts.
It's
there's
the craziest
like Tom Cruise
thing I've
getting
ever
into
seen.
The helicopter.
And I was in
him chasing that other helicopter down.
There's when the helicopter like goes down like the car out of the tree in Jurassic Park. Anyway, so like all this shit happens and I was sitting like backed up into the corner of my chair as far back as I could go from the screen, muttering Jesus Christ over and over again every time that Tom Cruise like fell off of something. Yeah, it's really incredible. I do think that it has like just a few too many like Henry Cavill's a double agent. You've got
bunch of Angela Bassett
like working against them. You've got too much Alec Baldwin for my taste, honestly, in this movie.
Oh, I forgot there's a whole fight scene involving Alec Baldwin.
Yeah, it's like I don't need to see Alec Baldwin do any of the stuff that he does in this movie. Like Rogue Nation was enough Alec Baldwin, where he's just like angry on the phone for most of the movie. And then Sean Harris, a few things I love about Sean Harris. Sean Harris, who plays Solomon Lane, who was the villain in Rogue Nation, and a criticism of Rogue Nation is that it didn't, like, Solomon Lane wasn't a great villain. The criticism of Ghost Protocol is it doesn't really even have a villain. It does, but it doesn't. Like, you're not really tracking a villain. And the praise for Mission Impossible 3 is that Owen Davian, who's played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, is the only great villain, maybe John Voight, but like is really the only great villain that the Mission Impossible franchise has had. But what Macquarie pointed out is that one of the reasons why Owen Davian is such a good villain, not just because he's played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, is because of the double fridging in Mission Impossible 3, where Mission Impossible 3 starts with him shooting Michelle Monaghan in the head, and then killing fucking Felicity, blowing up Felicity's brain. Owen Davian does that in the first like 15 minutes of the movie. So you're like, this is one scary bad dude. Like, this is a terrible dude. And I think, and Macquarie talked about how in Rogue Nation, they didn't want to like start it off with Solomon Lane, like killing.
Bah. He just shoots that record.
He shoots.
Agent.
Yeah. He shoots the record
in the back
girl.
Of the head.
He shoots a record girl, but they were like, we thought maybe he would kill Ving Rhames. We thought maybe he would kill Benji.
Like,
we thought
more.
He would maybe
kill...
Yeah,
he doesn't
like,
kill a named character.
Yeah,
no offense
like,
to Record Girl.
Yeah, Record Girl, it's like, you're like, fuck this dude. But you're not like, oh my God. Like, oh my God, you know? And so I do think that that makes Solomon Lane like somewhat of a weaker villain. But I actually really loved him in this one. I liked Solomon Lane with the side of Henry Cavill. And then Vanessa Kirby being like villainous, but not, but like camp. Also, a crazy Mission Impossible 1 callback that she's Vanessa Redgrave's daughter. That she just
How did I miss that?
She's when she's like giving her speech in the club, which looks like she's singing like a 1940s jazz song. Like there are
my mother Max.
She says my mother Max. So
that's crazy.
Yeah,
awesome.
So her mother is Vanessa Redgrave's character in the first Mission Impossible movie, but they just like say it and then don't lean on it at all. Which made me wonder, like, does she recognize Ethan Hunt if her mother was Max? You know what I mean? Like that the Vanessa Kirby thing is a little mysterious to me because she seems like she knows who he is. And
right.
She seems throughout. And maybe she does because she's like a CIA operative or like whatever. But I don't think they fully clarify, you know, the Vanessa Kirby of it all. But I'm fine with her just being like a weird loose cannon if that's what we want to like peg her as. That's fine.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes sense. I was going to say something there, and now I'm thrown off by the Vanessa Kirby thing.
But I, to answer your question from earlier, David, like the Michelle Monaghan is not like in Ghost Protocol, she's a cameo, and this is a major, like she has a major role to play in the final act. I think it's great. It's like the end of La La Land, except it's Wes Bentley instead of Tom Everett Scott. Wes Bentley is her.
Wes Bentley and his weird hairline.
Well, you can't say that in a movie where Simon Pegg is there doing whatever he's doing with his hair. But like,
it's really Wes Bentley's facial hairlines that are too geometric for me.
Maybe you're still thinking of his like Hunger Games beard, but like Wes Bentley, like, so she's married, Julia is married to Wes Bentley now, and they're like, they're in the Doctors Without Borders program. And like, Solomon Lane has manipulated it, so she is there at this refugee camp for the final showdown where there are like nuclear bombs involved. And he has orchestrated everything so that, you know, Ethan Hunt shows up and both Ilsa Faust and Julia are there, like the two women that he's cared about the most in his life. And so it's like this really, so it doesn't feel like, it doesn't feel shoehorned in. The only thing that feels shoehorned in maybe is that like Ethan Hunt has like a couple prophetic dreams about this, which I feel like is to maybe remind audiences who Julia is. So she doesn't just show up at the end and he's like, holy shit, it's Julia. Who the fuck is that? But like her being there, yeah, that's like a lot of hoops to jump through to get her there. But that's what Solomon Lane wants, is to jump through a lot of hoops to fuck with Ethan. And so then it works, I think, in the story. You know,
I do think, and this goes to your other sort of theory or observation that, you know, Christopher McQuarrie and Brad Bird really kind of get the idea that these movies are just about Tom. Mm-hmm. And I think that the better villains also, it's like a personal thing. Like it feels personal about Ethan Hunt. So Sean Harris wasn't great the first time around, but this time much better because it's like this personal thing that where he's just trying to fuck with Ethan Hunt. But I mean, he's also trying to like blow up stuff and spoil all the water in Asia or whatever. But it's also very personal. And I think you got that out of Philip Seymour Hoffman, in a sort of shorter time. Cause I think that character was better written and, sort of better conceived. But I think in the long run, they've discovered maybe their second best villain in this version of Lane.
What I want to say that I think is hilarious is Chris McQuarrie said on the Empire podcast that like, Sean Harris is like, didn't really want to do the movie in the first place, the first movie, Rogue Nation, but he's like, okay, but like, please be sure to kill me because I don't want to be in more of these. So he keeps having this line in this movie, you should have killed me, Hunt. And I'm like, that's Sean Harris, like speaking from the heart, like, fuck you, McQuarrie. I didn't want to be a franchise actor. I hate you.
Killed me.
Also, I will say this, since I'm on the topic of beards or facial hair, I far prefer Sean Harris with the beard.
Yeah.
I don't know what's going on with his face.
He's got a weird face.
He's got a weird face.
But he's got one of my favorite voices of all time.
Amazing voice.
Ving Rhames, who having watched the franchise in a week, I have seen Tom Cruise be like weirdly age defiant over the last 20 years. I've seen Ving Rhames not be age defiant. This is like our most I don't believe you're a field operative version of Ving Rhames in this movie. So he keeps getting tasks where he's like, I'll stay here and do this. You guys go run and fight and stuff.
He's really very quickly turning into the Danny Glover of this. He's very much too old for this shit.
Ving Rhames is way too old for this shit in this movie. But it's a lot of Ving in this movie because like Luther was a cameo in a couple of movies. And in this one, he's like, no, I'm super here for this movie. Another fun thing that I thought is interesting is like Chris McQuarrie was talking about what the rules of a Mission Impossible movie are. Like, what do you have to have for a Mission Impossible movie? And we could like rattle off some stuff, right? Like you need a stunt. Like hopefully there's something with a mask. Like, well,
motorcycle chase.
Right.
Breaking into somewhere to steal something.
Yeah. But he said that Tom's only rule actually is that Ethan Hunt gets a mission with like a good evening, Mr. Hunt or whatever, your mission should you choose to accept it. That's all Tom says, like has to be in the movie. So the one in this one, like this is when I was like, a little worried about Fallout. It starts with his mission. He gets it. Oh, a copy of what book? I forget. The Odyssey. I don't remember.
The Odyssey.
And it's kind of this like fun, old school projector tech, you know, like whatever. But then it's like this really complicated bit of exposition about here are the apostles. Here is the Dutch like nuclear scientist who has the information. Here are the three things of plutonium. And like it kept using all these icons to be like, the apostles want this scientist to get this plutonium to build these three bombs. I was like, this is like, it's too much. It's too much plot. I think Fallout has too much plot around all the amazing stunts. So that's what I think.
You know, that's a pretty fair criticism because there's a lot of bomb stuff. By the time we get to the actual nuclear bomb things, we know a lot about them.
Yeah.
And it's quite a lot. There's also a whole like side, I guess, part of the core story about how there's this person that they've never seen, this bad guy named John Lark that they've never seen. So there's a lot of confusion around who that is.
And then they try to pin it from the start. Like, right, clearly. Right.
And then, but they try to, like, every other Mission Impossible movie, they try to make Ethan Hunt out to be, like, he's snapped. Which, you know what? Now that we've talked through how both Tom Cruise and the character of Ethan Hunt are crazy, I could see how they would get there, to be honest. Oh, yeah, Ethan Hunt snapped? Yeah, that makes sense.
I do like that they tip the Henry Cavill hand, like, fairly early. When he gives Angela Bassett that phone and it's not cracked, like
right,
like the reveal, and that's like pretty early.
Oh, this guy's a bad guy.
This whole like lie that he's concocted about Ethan is actually about himself. Whoa, but also like I don't know, I feel like they could have made it clear either from the start that he was the bad guy. Like no, don't even pretend for a second that he's not. Or make it clear to me, like, when Angela Bassett knew what she knew. I want Angela Bassett to know things earlier. I want her to send him knowing who he was. That's what I want.
I think the other problem, potentially, for me at least, is I buy Henry Cavill as a dirty CIA guy who's, like, he kills too many people and is probably double-crossing a bunch of people. I don't buy him as, like, a zealot.
Yeah, because with a manifesto.
In the end, he's like a dude who has like this crazy manifesto about suffering and how religion controls people. And he's not an ideological figure to me. He is a man version of a weapon. I really liked Henry Cavill in this movie. Some of the physical stuff he does is really cool. And it's kind of fun to put like Tom Cruise with somebody who's just like bigger and stronger because it makes Tom Cruise more impressive somehow. His whole plot line is stupid. The bathroom fight's awesome.
That bathroom fight that's in the trailer is like incredible. It's really incredible. You like, and Henry Cavill is just like, I think they call him, what she call him? She calls like Tom Cruise, like a scalpel, like a precision tool.
And he's a hammer.
He's a hammer. And he is a hammer in that movie. It's really good. Like more, you know, more so than in anything I've seen him in. And Henry Cavill's always been a big dude, but like in Superman, I think he has to have some grace to him. And in this, he's just like a bruiser, you know, and it's pretty good. So All right.
So overall, very good. Dave, yeah. You should see it.
Yeah. So the mustache is worth it, huh?
I think the mustache is worth it.
I want to know who it was at Paramount, whether it was like David Ellison or whether it was McQuarrie himself, who it was who was like, no.
Yeah. I'm not shaving the mustache off for Warner Brothers.
Someone has to tell me that story someday.
That feels like old bad blood between two studios.
I know. So, yeah.
Although, now that I've seen what the mustache was for, I'm even more in the camp that he should have had the mustache in Justice League.
It's great. The mustache
is, just keep the mustache.
He has never looked better. The way his hair tumbles forward and the like stubble that goes with the mustache, he looks
great.
Friggin' great in this movie. Great, great evil bruiser. He's a great bad guy. Love him.
Henry Cavill. All right, I gotta see Fallout, and then I'll know if I'm right about the James Bond stuff. It sounds like I am. It sounds like the amount of plot that is in Fallout means that the connections to the greater Mission Impossible universe are sort of shaky at best. But we'll see. We'll see.
I don't think so. I feel like the Julia stuff is really important. Like, way more important
than flashbacks, he said.
No, she's there for, like, the whole final act of the movie.
Yeah, but they're like flashbacks to explain that.
Oh. I don't know.
James Bond has a wife. They just don't mention it unless they need to.
James Bond has a wife?
Yes, yeah. That's what Her Majesty's Secret Service is about. Anyway.
Wow.
More on that maybe next week. Neil, what's up? What are we doing next week?
Well, Dave, we're gonna have a little mystery episode, but it's specifically a Dave and Neil mystery episode because Joanna will be off next week. And so we haven't decided what we're going to talk about, but it will be a Dave and Neil mystery episode.
Dave and Neil, best of friends. One is the host of a podcast. The other is Neil.
So yeah, that'll be fun. But not too much fun. We prefer when Joanna's here. We won't have too much fun without you. I promise.
Is there a place that people could get at us with suggestions of mystery episode topics, even though we'll probably decide on our own?
For sure. You can tweet at us at Storm of Spoilers. You could tweet at Dave and I, obviously. You can also, if you're in the Slack, in our Patreon Slack, I'm not saying that your opinion is worth more. It's just I probably check Slack more than I do Twitter, which still... That's actually probably unhealthy. Get us in the Slack or tweet at the show at Storm of Spoilers. What would you like to hear from the Dave and Neil mystery episode? Who knows what it could be? Who knows what it's going to be?
Dave and Neil, best of friends. One is hosting his own site and the other one is Dave.
Dave and Neil, best of friends. They both have beards, at least for now.
Oh, that's a really good one.
Oh, yes. All right. Until next week's mystery segment, where could people, and for 2 weeks, Joanna, where could people find more of your work online?
You can find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. You can listen to me talk about the HBO series Sharp Objects on the Vanity Fair podcast, Still Watching, Sharp Objects. Otherwise, I will see you in Slack.
And Mr. Neil Miller.
You get me over on filmschoolrejects.com. Also, short plug for nonfix.com, which is the documentary website. It's the sister site of FSR. Is going to be relaunching with a new design, probably at the end of this week. So, if you like documentaries, check us out. You can also follow me on Twitter, at Rejects. And don't forget to follow the show. Don't forget to email us if you want. stormofspoilers@gmail.com. We do read your emails. That's a thing.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can find us at patreon.com/stormofspoilers, where you could become a subscriber to the show. That will get you all sorts of bonus content, starting at $1 a month. As little as $1 a month if you want some bonus content.
It's cheaper than a candy bar, which is real sad.
It is cheaper. It is cheaper than a candy bar, which didn't used to be the case. Used to be, I could make phone call. Anyway, not important. make phone calls off the street from a phone that wasn't mine.
What?
It was crazy. Back in my day, there was two Mission Impossible movies.
Week's bonus segment in old timey talk.
You bet. and so until next week, for the rest of you, I don't care if you're, you know, after the rabbit's foot or stealing something from a computer server submerged in water or in some sort of helicopter chase. Please do not fall down.
Oh, man.
You're getting old and we're worried about you.
Tom fell down so many times this year.
Oh, my gosh. Or the Cobalt Syndicate will come for you. All right. MacGuffin, MacGuffin, MacGuffin. Bye.
MacGuffin Impossible. That'll be the last one. Nice warm bed. You just remember what your old past said. Boy, you got a friend in me. 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 You got a friend in me.